Welcome to the Deep Dive. Okay, today we're embarking on quite an incredible journey. We're going right to the absolute cutting edge of physics.
Really exploring the frontiers.
Exactly, exploring the frontiers of modern research. And our mission, you know, as always, is to kind of sift through this huge landscape of scientific ideas.
From the incredibly small.
Yeah, the tiniest particles making up reality, all the way to the, well, the biggest structures in the universe. We want to pull out the really key nuggets of knowledge and maybe some surprising facts for you, our listener.
And it's such a vast landscape, isn't it? This deep dive. It's going to touch on so many diverse areas.
Okay.
We're talking fundamental physics, of course, but also astrophysics, solid state physics,
right,
and even, you know, the complexity you find in biophysics or climatology. It's fascinating.
It is.
And what's really amazing, I think, is seeing how these fields, which can seem so separate, mm-hmm. are actually deeply interconnected. They all feed into this bigger picture, our understanding of the universe.
That interconnectedness, that's exactly what we want to try and uncover today. So let's start with something pretty tangible, something you might actually, you know, hold. Matter.
Good place to start.
We're seeing these just astonishing breakthroughs in material science, right? Things like graphene, carbon nanotubes. It kind of makes you wonder, are we like on the verge of finding new states of matter? Beyond solid liquid gas.
It's a really compelling thought, and it connects directly to the core ideas in solid state physics.
Okay.
When we look at crystalline solids, the way atoms are arranged, we can understand how they behave by looking at their energy bands.
Energy bands.
Yeah. Think about electrons in a single atom having specific energy levels. Well, in the solid, these levels kind of smear out into bands. You get valence bands, where electrons are normally stuck to atoms,
right.
And conduction bands, where they can actually move freely. That's what allows electricity to flow.
And there are gaps between them.
Exactly. Forbidden bands or energy gaps, where electrons just can't exist.
Mm-hmm.
And the size of that gap is crucial. It determines if something's a conductor, where the bands overlap, electrons move easily,
mm-hmm.
or an insulator. With a huge gap.
Okay.
Or a semiconductor, which has this sort of narrow, manageable gap.
Ah, so semiconductors are like in that sweet spot, the Goldilocks zone.
Precisely.
Where we can actually tinker with how they conduct electricity. They're interesting just on their own, these intrinsic ones. But then there's this technique, doping.
Yes.
How does adding just a tiny bit of something else change it so fundamentally?
Mm-hmm.
Creating these, what are they, N-type and P-type materials, mm-hmm. and what are these holes people talk about?
That's an excellent question. So an intrinsic or pure semiconductor has a pretty balanced number of electrons ready to conduct, and these holes.
Okay.
Now, a hole isn't really a particle. It's just the absence of an electron where you'd expect one to be in the crystal structure.
Mm-hmm.
But crucially, it acts like it has a positive charge.
Ah, okay. Like a bubble in water.
Sort of, yeah.
Yeah.
It behaves like a positive charge carrier.
Right.
Now, doping is when we deliberately add specific impurity atoms. If you add donor atoms, they have extra electrons to give away.
Right.
That makes the material N-type for negative, because electrons, the negative charges, become the main carriers of current.
Got it.
If you add acceptor atoms, they readily accept electrons, which means they effectively create more holes.
Ah.
And that makes it a P-type semiconductor for positive, where these positive acting holes are the majority carriers.
And this precise control, having these N-types and P-types,
yeah.
what's the, you know, the big payoff? How does that get us from this sort of abstract idea to, well, the phone in my pocket?
Right. This is where it gets really powerful technologically.
Yeah.
When you strategically join a piece of P-type and a piece of N-type semiconductor,
okay.
you create what's called a PN junction. And this junction is amazing. It acts like a one-way street for electric current.
A valve?
Exactly, a valve.
Yeah.
Lets current flow easily one way, but blocks it almost completely the other way. That's a semiconductor diode.
A rectifier.
Precisely. And this sort of dynamic region near the junction, the diode plasma, with all its mobile electrons and holes,
mm.
is key to how it controls that flow.
Okay, so that's the diode. What about transistors?
Ah, the transistor. That was the real revolution. You can think of it basically as sandwiching two PN junctions together, like PNP or NPN.
Right.
And what this structure allows is for a tiny current in one part to control a much larger current flowing through the whole thing. It acts as a tiny, super efficient switch, but also as a current amplifier.
Amplifier, okay.
And that ability to switch and amplify electronically using these tiny solid-state devices instead of big, hot vacuum tubes,
mm-hmm.
That's what allowed us to shrink computers from filling rooms down to, well, chips smaller than your fingernail. It absolutely built the digital world.
It's really astounding. Just that fundamental understanding unlocking all this incredible technology. Okay, let's pivot now from the practical, maybe, to the truly mind-bending. This is where it gets really interesting, I think. We're going to dive into the incredibly, unbelievably small, the subatomic world.
The quantum realm.
Yeah. So what are the key elementary particles down there, the fundamental bits? And how on earth do physicists even, like, detect these things? They're so elusive.
Well, in this zoo of elementary particles, we have fundamental building blocks like leptons. Most think that lepton is the electron, of course.
Sure.
But there are also the neutrinos, much more mysterious. We have electron neutrinos, muon neutrinos, tau neutrinos. And they're fascinating because they do this thing called neutrino oscillations.
Oscillations, they change.
Yeah, they actually change flavor or identity as they fly through space. An electron neutrino can turn into a muon neutrino, for example.
Whoa.
And discovering that was huge because it proved that neutrinos, which people initially thought were massless, must actually have a tiny bit of mass. Otherwise, they couldn't oscillate like that.
Wow. Okay. So leptons?
Yeah.
What else?
Then you have the quarks. These are the guys that combine to form bigger particles, like the protons and neutrons inside atomic nuclei.
Right. Protons and neutrons aren't fundamental then.
Nope. They're made of quarks, usually combinations of three quarks.
Okay. And for pretty much every particle, there's an antiversion, an antiparticle.
That's right. Antimatter.
Like the antineutron, antiproton, positron. How do you even see these things? They just annihilate when they meet normal matter, right? Into pure energy.
Exactly. Every particle has an antimatter twin. Same mass, but opposite charge and some other quantum properties. The electron's antiparticle is the positron, which is positive.
Okay.
And yes, when a particle meets its antiparticle, poof, annihilation. They convert their mass directly into energy, usually high-energy photons, gamma rays, according to EMCR. We observe them either by creating them in high-energy collisions and accelerators, and then watching their specific tracks in detectors before they hit anything, or by seeing the burst of energy when they do annihilate.
Which brings us to these giant machines, the particle accelerators. How do those work? What are the big ones?
Particle accelerators are incredible tools. Basically, they use powerful electric fields to boost particles, like protons or electrons, to incredibly high speeds, close to the speed of light.
Okay.
And then they use strong magnetic fields to steer them, either in a straight line, like a linear accelerator or LINAC, or around a huge ring, like a synchrotron.
Like the LHC.
Exactly like the Large Hadron Collider, the LHC, at CERN. That's the biggest synchrotron in the world right now. There are others, too, like the old proton synchrotron, the PS, also at CERN, or the alternating gradient synchrotron, AGS, in the U.S. The goal is to smash these high-energy particles together or into a target.
To see what comes out?
Precisely.
Right.
To recreate conditions similar to the very early universe, just after the Big Bang, and see what fundamental particles and forces emerge.
But how do you see it? When these things smash together at near light speed, it must be chaos. What kind of detectors do you need?
You need incredibly sophisticated particle detectors, huge, complex instruments. Early on, scientists used things like cloud chambers or bubble chambers.
Right, you could literally see the tracks.
Yeah, the particles would leave little trails of bubbles or fog as they passed through a special liquid or gas. Very visual.
Cool.
Nowadays, it's much more electronic. We use things like wire chambers or silicon detectors, which electronically record the position and timing of particles passing through. And for neutrinos, which barely interact with anything, you need absolutely massive detectors.
Like underground tanks?
Often, yeah. Built deep underground to shield them from other cosmic radiation, filled with water or other liquids, waiting for that rare neutrino interaction. Huge experiments like Icarus or the SBN program. These detectors are designed to measure the energy, momentum, charge, and identity of potentially hundreds or thousands of particles produced in a single collision.
Amazing. So, okay, we have all these particles, quarks, leptons, antiparticles, and they're interacting. This leads us to the fundamental forces, right? There are four.
Yes, the four fundamental forces that seem to govern everything in the universe as we currently understand it.
Let's tick them off. Electromagnetic.
Right, the electromagnetic force, responsible for pretty much all of chemistry and biology, really. Electricity, magnetism, light itself. It holds atoms together. It's mediated or carried by the photon.
Okay.
Or it's described beautifully by the theory of quantum electrodynamics, or QED, which is basically quantum mechanics combined with Maxwell's classical theory of electromagnetism. We even talk about virtual photons mediating the force between charges.
Okay, force number one. Number two, the weak force.
The weak force, or weak nuclear interaction. This one's responsible for certain types of radioactive decay, like beta decay, where a neutron can turn into a proton, an electron, and an antineutrino.
Ah, so it changes particles.
Exactly. It allows quarks and leptons to change their type. It's called weak because its influence is much shorter range and generally less strong than electromagnetism or the strong force. It has its own carrier particles, the W and Z bosons.
Got it. Then the strong force. Sounds important.
It is. The strong force, or strong nuclear interaction. As the name suggests, it's the strongest of the forces, but it only acts over incredibly short distances, basically within the nucleus of an atom.
What does it do?
It's what binds quarks together inside protons and neutrons, and it's also what holds the protons and neutrons themselves together in the atomic nucleus, overcoming the electromagnetic repulsion between the positively charged protons.
Ah, okay.
It's described by quantum chromodynamics, or QCD, and its force carriers are called gluons.
Gluons, right. Okay, and the last one, the one we all know, gravity.
Gravity, the gravitational force. Oddly enough, it's by far the weakest of the four forces at the particle level, but it acts over infinite distances and is always attractive between masses.
So it dominates on large scales.
Exactly. It governs the orbits of planets, stars, galaxies. Its theoretical force carrier particle is called the graviton, but we haven't directly detected one yet. Gravity is the realm of Einstein's general relativity.
Okay, so four forces, and three of them, plus all the particles we talked about, quarks, leptons, they fit into this amazing framework, the Standard Model, right?
Absolutely. The Standard Model of particle physics is one of the towering achievements of 20th century science. It uses the principles of quantum field theory, QFT, to describe the electromagnetic weak and strong forces and all the known elementary particles.
And it's incredibly successful.
Phenomenally successful. Its predictions have been tested and confirmed to extraordinary precision in countless experiments. It really works beautifully for the three forces it covers.
Right. Gravity's still the odd one out.
It is. Integrating gravity into a quantum framework is the big challenge.
And central to the Standard Model, or at least a key part discovered more recently, is the Higgs field and the Higgs boson. Why was finding the Higgs such a big deal?
Ah, the Higgs. It's absolutely crucial. The Higgs mechanism explains how fundamental particles actually get their mass.
It gives them mass.
The theory suggests that the entire universe is permeated by this invisible Higgs field. As particles move through this field, they interact with it.
Okay.
Think of it like moving through treacle or thick syrup. Some particles interact very strongly with the Higgs field. They feel a lot of drag, and that manifests as having a large mass.
Like pushing something heavy.
Exactly. Other particles interact only weakly, so they have small mass. And some, like the photon, don't interact with the Higgs field at all, so they have zero mass and travel at the speed of light.
Wow, so mass isn't intrinsic, it's from interacting with this field.
That's the idea. It's called particle coupling to the Higgs field. And the Higgs boson, the particle discovered at the LHC in 2012, is an excitation, like a ripple, in this field. Finding it was the confirmation of this whole mechanism.
And it connects to the weak force, too, something about symmetry breaking.
Yes, very important point. In the very hot early universe, the electromagnetic and weak forces are thought to have been unified, behaving as a single electroweak force. As the universe cooled down very rapidly, the Higgs field condensed or turned on, and this caused what's called electroweak symmetry breaking. The forces split into the distinct electromagnetic and weak forces we see today, and the W and Z bosons, carriers of the weak force, acquired mass through the Higgs mechanism, while the photon remained massless.
Fascinating. Okay, so we've gone deep into the small. Let's zoom way out now to the unimaginably vast. Gravity and the cosmos.
Einstein's domain.
Exactly. Einstein's general relativity. It just completely changed how we think about gravity and the universe itself. What were the absolute core revolutionary ideas there?
General relativity, or GR, is just profound. Its central idea is that gravity isn't a force pulling objects together through empty space. Instead, it's the curvature of space-time itself.
Space-time? Not just space.
No, space and time woven together into a four-dimensional fabric. And this fabric gets warped and curved by the presence of mass and energy. And objects, like planets or light rays, simply follow the straightest possible paths, geodesics, through this curved space-time. What we perceive as gravity is just objects following these curves.
Well, the Earth orbits the Sun because the Sun curves space-time around it, and the Earth is just following that curve.
That's the essence of it. It's geometry, not just a force. Another key idea is the equivalence principle.
Right. What's that again?
It basically says that you can't tell the difference between being in a gravitational field and being accelerated. Like, standing on Earth feels the same as being in a rocket accelerating at 9.8 meter Earths.
Okay.
And conversely, being in free fall, like an astronaut in orbit, feels exactly the same as being weightless in deep space, far from any gravity. It connects gravity and acceleration fundamentally.
And it means we have to use weird geometry, not the flat Euclidean stuff.
Exactly. Space-time near mass is curved, so we need non-Euclidean geometry to describe it accurately. The rules of geometry change. Parallel lines might meet. Triangles don't add up to 180 degrees.
Wild. Okay, so what are the, like, real-world proofs or consequences of this curved space-time idea? Things we can actually see.
Oh, there are several classic tests. Einstein's field equations, which mathematically describe how mass curves space-time, predicted things nobody had seen before.
Like what?
Like the tiny anomalous precession of Mercury's orbit. Its elliptical path around the Sun slowly rotates over time, just a tiny bit more than Newtonian gravity could explain. GR predicted the amount perfectly.
Okay, that's subtle. Anything more dramatic?
Definitely. The gravitational deflection of light. GR predicts that light rays should bend as they pass near a massive object because the space-time itself is bent.
And then we've seen that.
Yes. Famously confirmed during a solar eclipse in 1919 by observing starlight bending as it passed near the Sun. It leads to this amazing phenomenon called gravitational lensing.
Lensing, like a magnifying glass.
Exactly. A massive galaxy or cluster of galaxies between us and a more distant object can bend the light from the background object, acting like a cosmic lens. It can magnify the distant object, distort its shape, even create multiple images of the same object.
Multiple images.
Yeah, sometimes you see configurations like the Einstein cross, where a single distant quasar appears as four distinct images arranged around the foreground lensing galaxy. It's direct visual evidence of space-time curvature.
That's incredible. And when gravity gets really, really extreme, black holes.
Black holes. The ultimate expression of curved space-time. Objects so dense that their gravity warps space-time so severely that nothing, not even light, can escape once it crosses a certain boundary.
The event horizon.
Event horizon, yes.
Yeah.
The point of no return.
What other weird effects happen near them?
GR predicts some truly strange things near black holes. Gravitational redshift, where light trying to escape loses energy, shifting its wavelength towards red. And gravitational time dilation. Time itself actually passes more slowly closer to a massive object. So for an observer near a black hole's event horizon, time would tick much slower compared to someone far away.
Wow. Time slows down. They can shoot out jets.
Yes. Incredibly powerful jets of matter moving at near light speed are often seen blasting out from the regions around supermassive black holes at the centers of galaxies. We don't fully understand the mechanism, but it involves the intense gravitational and magnetic fields.
Mind-boggling stuff. Okay, speaking of incredible phenomena, gravitational waves. Detecting those was huge news a few years back. How do we actually hear these ripples in space-time?
It was absolutely a landmark discovery.
Yeah.
A Nobel Prize winner. Gravitational waves are literally ripples, disturbances in the fabric of space-time itself.
Caused by
the acceleration of massive objects, especially violent cosmic events, like two black holes merging or two neutron stars colliding. These events shake space-time, sending out waves that travel at the speed of light.
And we can detect these tiny ripples here on Earth.
It takes incredibly sensitive instruments called interferometers, like the LIGO and Virgo detectors on the ground. They use lasers bounced down long tunnels. A passing gravitational wave stretches and squeezes space-time by a minuscule amount.
Like, unimaginably small.
Absolutely tiny. Less than the width of a proton over several kilometers. But these detectors can measure that tiny change in the laser path length. And now there are plans for space-based detectors like LISA, the Laser Interferometer Space Antenna.
LISA.
Which will be even more sensitive and capable of detecting different frequencies of gravitational waves, perhaps from merging supermassive black holes. It's truly opened a new window on the universe. We can now listen to cosmic events, not just see them.
Amazing. Okay, let's zoom out even further. Cosmology, the whole universe story. The basics are the expansion, right? Hubble, redshift.
That's the foundation, the observation that the universe is expanding. Edwin Hubble, back in the 1920s, showed that distant galaxies are moving away from us.
And the farther away they are, the faster they move.
Exactly. That relationship is quantified by the Hubble constant. and we know they're moving away because of redshift.
Like a Doppler effect for sound.
Very similar principle. As a galaxy recedes, the light waves it emits get stretched out, shifting their wavelength towards the red end of the spectrum.
Yeah.
The amount of redshift tells us how fast it's moving away.
Okay. And this expanding universe points back to a beginning, the Big Bang model.
Yes, the Big Bang model is our standard cosmological model. It posits that the universe began in an incredibly hot, dense state about 13.8 billion years ago and has been expanding and cooling ever since.
What's the strongest evidence for that? Sounds pretty wild.
It does, but the evidence is compelling. One of the absolute pillars is the cosmic microwave background radiation, or CMB.
The afterglow.
Exactly. The faint heat left over from the very hot early universe. It was predicted by the Big Bang Theory and then discovered in the 1960s. Satellites like COBE and especially WMAP and Planck have mapped this CMB radiation in incredible detail. Its temperature, its tiny variations, they perfectly match the predictions of a universe that started hot and dense and expanded.
Any other big pieces of evidence?
Well, the observed abundances of light elements like hydrogen, helium, and lithium in the universe also match the predictions of element formation in the first few minutes after the Big Bang. And there's also the inflationary model.
Inflation, what's that?
It's in addition to the basic Big Bang theory. It proposes an incredibly rapid exponential expansion inflation that happened in the very first fraction of a second.
Why do we need that?
It solves some puzzles, like why the universe looks so incredibly uniform and flat on large scales. Inflation would have smoothed out any initial wrinkles very effectively.
Okay, so the Big Bang with inflation is the standard picture. But there are still huge mysteries, aren't there? Like dark matter and dark energy.
Oh, absolutely. These are probably the biggest puzzles in physics and cosmology today. Together, they seem to make up about 95% of the total energy density of the universe.
95%. And we don't know what they are.
We have ideas, but no definitive answers yet.
Yeah.
Dark matter is some kind of matter that doesn't interact with light. Hence, dark. We can't see it directly.
But we know it's there. How?
Because of its gravity. We see its gravitational effects everywhere. In the rotation speeds of galaxies. In the way galaxies move within clusters. In gravitational lensing. There's way more gravity than visible matter can account for.
So what could it be?
The leading candidates are hypothetical particles called WIMPs, weakly interacting massive particles. Things like neutralinos, predicted by some theories beyond the standard model. Experiments like LUX, the large underground xenon experiment, are trying desperately to detect these WIMPs directly as they pass through the Earth. So far, no luck.
Okay, that's dark matter. What about dark energy? That sounds even weirder.
It is, in many ways. Dark energy is the name we give to whatever is causing the expansion of the universe to accelerate.
Accelerate? I thought gravity would be slowing it down.
That's what everyone thought, too. But observations of distant supernovae in the late 1990s showed the expansion is actually speeding up.
Wow. So dark energy pushes things apart, like anti-gravity.
Effectively, yes. It seems to exert a kind of gravitational repulsion on cosmological scales. Its nature is a complete mystery. It might be related to Einstein's old idea of a cosmological constant, an energy inherent to empty space itself.
And this balance between regular matter, and dark energy determines the universe's fate, like the critical density.
Exactly. The total density of all forms of matter and energy determines the overall geometry and future evolution of the universe. Whether it expands forever, collapses back, or reaches a flat state depends on this balance, especially the mysterious dark energy component.
Okay. So bringing it all together, the ultimate goal, the holy grail of physics, seems to be scientific unification, right? Finding one theory for everything.
That's the grand ambition, the drive to unify the fundamental forces. We saw electroweak unification successfully brought together electromagnetism and the weak force.
Right.
The next logical step would be to include the strong force as well. That's the idea behind grand unified theories, or GUTs, sometimes called electroforce unification.
A theory where all three standard model forces merge into one at very high energies.
Precisely. At the incredibly high energies thought to exist just moments after the Big Bang, these forces might have all been aspects of a single unified interaction.
And to even talk about those energies, we need these concepts like Planck magnitudes, Planck energy, Planck time.
Yes. The Planck scale. Max Planck figured out these fundamental units based on universal constants. Planck energy is incredibly high. Planck time and Planck length are incredibly small.
And what do they represent?
They represent the physical scale where our current theories, general relativity and quantum mechanics, are expected to break down because the effects of both quantum mechanics and gravity become equally strong.
So that's where we need a theory of quantum gravity.
Exactly. To describe physics at the Planck scale, you need a theory that successfully merges quantum mechanics and gravity. That's the missing piece for true unification.
So what are the candidates, the proposed theories trying to achieve this grand unification in quantum gravity?
There are a few leading contenders, though none are experimentally confirmed yet. One is supersymmetry, or UEY.
Supersymmetry. What's the core idea?
So UEY proposes a fundamental symmetry between the two basic types of elementary particles. Fermions, matter particles like quarks and leptons, and bosons, force carriers like photons and gluons.
Okay.
It predicts that every known particle has a heavier supersymmetric companion, worse particle. So for the photon, there'd be a photino, for the electron, a selectron, for quarks, quarks, and so on.
And finding these particles would be evidence.
Huge evidence, yes.
Yeah.
The LHC and other experiments have been looking hard for them, but so far, nothing definitive. If Susie is right, it could also potentially help explain dark matter, as the lightest supersymmetric particle is a good WIMP candidate.
Interesting. What else is out there? String theory.
String theory is another major approach. It takes a radical step and says that the fundamental constituents of reality aren't point-like particles at all, but tiny, vibrating, one-dimensional loops or strands, quantum strings.
Strings.
Yeah. And just like a violin string can vibrate at different frequencies to produce different musical notes, these fundamental strings can vibrate in different ways. And the different vibrational modes correspond to the different elementary particles we see, electrons, quarks, photons, even the graviton.
So particles are just different notes played by these strings.
That's the analogy, yes.
Yeah.
It's mathematically very elegant, and it naturally incorporates gravity. But it also requires extra spatial dimensions beyond our usual three, which are somehow curled up and hidden. And testing it experimentally is incredibly difficult.
Okay. Any other big ideas?
Another significant approach is loop quantum gravity, or LQG. It takes a different path. Instead of starting with particles, it tries to directly quantize space-time itself.
Quantize space-time, making it chunky.
In a sense, yes. LQG suggests that space isn't a smooth continuum, but is actually composed of discrete, indivisible quantum loops, or units of area and volume at the Planck scale. Space-time itself becomes granular, foamy.
Wow. So three big contenders: supersymmetry, string theory, loop quantum gravity.
Those are probably the most developed frameworks aiming for quantum gravity and unification, each with its own strengths and challenges.
And the absolute ultimate goal of all this, nailing down the universal physical constants, maybe even explaining why they have the values they do, perhaps even leading to ideas like the multiverse, all aiming for that final theory of everything.
That really is the dream, isn't it?
Yeah.
A single, consistent theory of everything, or TOEI, that provides a complete map of space and time. It would hopefully explain the values of the universal physical constants.
Yeah.
Why is the speed of light what it is? Why is the charge of the electron that specific value? And maybe it would even tell us if our universe is unique. The idea of a multiverse, where our universe is just one bubble among countless others, perhaps with different laws or constants, arises naturally in some of these frameworks, like string theory and eternal inflation. A TOEI would be the ultimate extension of all scientific theories.
What an absolutely incredible journey we've covered today. I mean, from the structure of everyday materials down to quarks and gluons, then out to the curvature of space-time, black holes, the Big Bang, dark energy.
It's mind-bending stuff.
It really is. The sheer scope of modern physics research and the absolutely fundamental questions it's trying to answer, it's just awe-inspiring.
It truly is. And maybe that brings us to a final thought, a question really for you, our listener. Given all this incredible progress we've discussed, unifying our understanding of forces, particles, the cosmos, what do you personally think is the next really big frontier in physics research? What's the next major mystery to crack?
Yeah, and maybe searching about what impact solving that mystery might actually have on our technology, our understanding, maybe even our daily lives down the road.
Exactly. Something to ponder. What's the next horizon?